Welcome to the Deathcast.
Friday, July 10th, 1981, the small town of Skidmore, Missouri. The local Elks Lodge, a group of men have gathered to discuss their current problem. A man who has tormented them all for decades. His name is Ken McElroy. Inside that Elks Lodge, the local sheriff, a man named Estes, pleads with the gathered throng not to confront Elroy head-on, as he knows all too well that the man is a violent, conniving offender. In fact, his most recent crime, that of the shooting of a local shopkeep in the face with a shotgun, is the reason they are all gathered there on that morning. Estes notices that the thrum has begun to make its way through the crowd, a pulsing, living thing that starts at one end of the room and worms its way through all of those who are gathered. It seems to him that there is a vibrancy in the air, as though a guitar string has been struck and left to sing. Soon, the sheriff knows why. A pickup truck has been spotted on Main Street, parked out in front of the DMD lounge. Its driver, none other than Ken McElroy. Once again, Estes pleads with the men not to confront him. His words fall on deaf ears. As one, the gathered mass exits the Elks Lounge and heads down the street. They notice the young woman sitting in the passenger seat of the pickup truck, McElroy's child bride, Trina. They pay her no mind as they file inside the bar. Inside, they find a heavy-set hound dog-faced man with a large pompadour, drinking silently. They fill the small room until they are nearly crowding each other out. McElroy continues to drink, unmindful of their presence. When he is at last finished, he pays the man behind the bar, purchases a six-pack of beer, and exits. The men inside the bar watch him leave before filing out after him. McElroy climbs behind the wheel of the truck, his great girth making the seats squeal in protest. And then all hell breaks loose as gunfire shatters the still morning air. When it is all over, when the smoke and stench of cordite have cleared, Ken McElroy lies dead. His wife Trina, unharmed, beyond the emotional scars she will carry with her for the rest of her life. This is the Deathcast, and this is the story of Ken Rex McElroy. Hello again, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, independent best-selling author Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you for joining me this week as we look at the life, crimes, and death of Ken McElroy. Before we get there, though, I'd like to thank everyone who's been supporting the show since its start and helping it to grow by posting about it on social media and messaging me to let me know what you think of the show. I really do appreciate it, and beyond writing and professional wrestling, it's one of my true passions. If you would like to get involved and interact with me online, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Author Totten. That's one word, capital A-U-T-H-O-R, capital T-O-T-T-E-N. You can also find me on Facebook at Ian Totten Author. Click like, and then you can explore it and find the page that's dedicated strictly to the Deathcast. If you would like to help support the show, you can find me on Patreon at Ian Totten Author. For those of you on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher, please consider leaving a 5-star review. It really does help the show. If you have an idea for a show, a case that you would like to hear me talk about, please contact me at authoriantotten@gmail.com and throw along my way. I can't say when I will get to your topic, but I promise I take every idea under consideration. With that, let's go into the crypt. couple things before we really get into the case of Ken McElroy and Skidmore, Missouri. Seeing as it's Thanksgiving week, which I hope you've all enjoyed, I thought it might be fun to look at a case that, while it does involve murder, isn't as horrific as the ones I normally cover. In fact, this case you could almost say is more of a community bonding, neighbors standing up for each other type of thing, which, given our current world today, I thought it was only apropos. Ken Rex McElroy was born June 1st, 1934, in Overland Park, Kansas. He was the 15th of 16 children born to Tony and Mabel McElroy. Now, the family bounced between Kansas and the Ozarks as they were tenant farmers, and it's McElroy's upbringing has been described as extremely impoverished. Eventually, the family settled in Skidmore, Missouri, which is a town that's in the extreme northwestern part of the state. It's a sparsely populated farming community. I've read multiple accounts about McElroy's life, and one constant that seems to stand out is that at growing up, he was largely left unattended by his parents, which, given the time period and the size of the family, isn't all that surprising. It's also been stated that at some point he received a fairly serious head trauma, although what that is I haven't been exactly able to discern. I would suspect that as the children were outdoorsy country children, it probably involved a bicycle or possibly falling from a tree or a swing. At any rate, by the time that he entered school, McElroy was seen as a troublemaker who was incorrigible. Teachers described him as a slow learner. By the time McElroy was in eighth grade, he was nearly illiterate and he decided to drop out. And it wasn't long after this that he began to build the reputation that still lives in the town of Skidmore today. He was considered to be an expert raccoon trapper. He also was known to breed hunting dogs, and he was seen as something of a tough customer. If you were to take all the movie badasses that Hollywood has produced all throughout the years and put them all together, you might be able to come close to the type of individual McElroy was. He lived by his own set of rules. In his mind, laws didn't apply to him because McElroy did whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted, to whoever he wanted. I'm going to be posting pictures of him on social media. He has this look about him, especially in his later years, of just imagine, you know, fat Elvis when the drugs run out and he's permanently pissed off. That's the air that McElroy gives off. He's got these huge black sideburns that come down his face and kind of taper off into a jagged edge that runs out into the middle of his cheeks. And it might have been this look that first set people on edge when he began stealing cars and committing petty thefts. Now, when confronted about these crimes, McElroy had no qualms about knocking whoever it was that was standing in his way around, whether it be the property's owner or local law enforcement. McElroy had no problem busting some heads to make certain he got what he wanted. He eventually graduated. He was involved in cattle rustling, and basically what he would do there is he and a couple buddies would go to a field at night and steal some cows and bring them back to the property that McElroy owned and put them there. And when the landowner would show up to collect their cows, Mick Elroy would have already rebranded them with his own brand, and then, you know, basically goad the individual into fighting him over it. Most of the time, the police, they couldn't be bothered. You know, they knew Mick Elroy's reputation, and they would simply tell the landowner to forget it, let's move along. And it was things like this, these getting away with these smaller crimes, that allowed him to escalate his criminal activities greatly. He was involved in any kind of criminal enterprise that you can think of, whether this was stealing grain or gasoline, racing dogs, fighting dogs, illegal gambling. Whatever there was in that area for him to do that was illegal in order to make money, Ken McElroy had his hand in the pie. Now, he did have one legal enterprise, and that was that he would lease land to different individuals. But for the most part, all of his enterprises were away from the eyes of the law. And he had no problem intimidating people either. A number of times he committed a crime and the person wasn't willing to go. Well, Ken McElroy had no problem showing up at their house and smacking them, their children, even their wives around. I read a couple different accounts where McElroy, to put fear into the people, would actually show up and rape the individual's wife to let them know who was boss. But he didn't stop there. You know, there's a lot of cases out there where, you know, witness intimidation is a factor. Ken McElroy took this to a completely new extreme. He wouldn't just go and intimidate them. Ken McElroy would show up at their house in his car and drive up and down the street for hours on end, day after day after day. And it was almost like he had a sixth sense, because when the police would show up, McElroy would be nowhere to be found. But after they left, there he was again, doing the same thing over and over again. His intimidation tactics weren't just limited to this, however. McElroy was known to use weapons on people. On at least two occasions, he opened fire on people who were attempting to turn evidence against him. All told, over the course of his life, Ken McElroy was indicted at least 18 times. He was never convicted of any of those crimes, which goes to show you the fear and reverence that the people in Skidmore held him in, because a lot of these crimes, they weren't nickel and dime things. They were things, you know, such as stealing people's car and selling them to the Dixie Mafia, you know, the aforementioned cattle rustling. I've seen a few things that say he might have been involved in drug smuggling. So he was involved in some pretty heavy-duty stuff throughout the years. His lawyer, Richard McFadden, said that McElroy was in court estimated three times a year, which, you stretch that over decades, that's a whole lot more than 18 times. But, you know, as I said, only 18 of those court appearances went beyond the initial hearing. So his intimidation methods obviously worked. As I stated earlier, you know, McElroy was a bit of a womanizer. Quite a bit of the time, however, this was not consensual. Ken McElroy was the type of person who didn't see things like age as being a barrier. There's a number of accounts of him raping girls as young as 11 and 12, but also going after married women and then getting physically violent with the woman's spouse or boyfriend when confronted with the illegality of his actions. McElroy fathered at least 10 children, and he's known to have married 4 times. He was a very domineering, abusive husband that treated his spouse as little more than a personal slave. His final wife, Trina, met McElroy when she was 12. She was in the 8th grade, and not long after meeting him, he began raping her repeatedly. Now, I haven't seen anything where Trina reported this to anyone like teachers or parents or authorities, but given McElroy's past, it's doubtful that even if she had, anything would have or could have been done about it. She did keep going back to him, which leads me to believe that there had been some form of grooming process involved before he raped her, and she could very possibly have come from a troubled home. So in her young mind, the attention she was getting from Ken was better than the type that she was getting at home. This happens a lot in abuse cases, whether it's with children or adults. They almost come to crave the abuse that is given to them because they want that attention so badly from the abuser. Because the person who is doing the abuse has warped their mind so much through the grooming process that, yes, it makes them feel ashamed, but at the same time, it makes them feel wanted. And I suspect that was what was going on between the two of them. When Trina was 14, she became pregnant and was forced to drop out of school. McElroy had Trina move into the house that he was living in with his then current wife, which were in a normal situation would have almost instantly ended the marriage and resulted in charges for McElroy. But he was anything but normal, and the women that he attracted fell into this category as well. I have read that McElroy continued to carry on a sexual relationship with Trina, despite the fact that his wife was in the house and knew about it. And he eventually convinced his wife to grant him a divorce so that he could marry Trina and avoid possible statutory rape charges. Not long after Trina gave birth and came back to McElroy's house, she and his former wife fled and went to stay with Trina's parents. Eventually, McElroy tracked them down and forced them to return home with them. This next part has never been proven, although it's highly suspected McElroy was responsible. The evening that the former Mrs. McElroy and Trina returned to stay with Ken, Trina's parents' dog was shot and their house was burned down. This would fall within the boundaries of the type of intimidation Ken McElroy would implore. In this case, it was no matter where you go, who you're with, whose house you're at, I can get you, I can get your loved ones, and you're gonna come back and stay with me no matter what or else. This all went down in 1973. In June of that year, McElroy was charged with arson, assault, and statutory rape. He was arrested, but eventually released on $2,500. The fallout to these charges was that Trina and the baby were placed into foster care. And shortly after being released from jail, McElroy located the foster home that she was staying in, and he employed his normal tactics of parking in front of the house and staring at the family, driving around the block. He approached the family on a few occasions and threatened to kidnap their daughter, going so far as to tell them what school was she went to and explain her bus route to the parents. and he said that he would take her in order to exchange her for Trina and the child. More charges piled on, but again, there was no consequences for Ken McElroy. They were eventually dropped. Trina and the baby were allowed to come and stay with him again. His next set of charges came on July 27th, 1976. McElroy was shooting on another man's property when the property owner, a farmer whose last name has been recorded as Henry, approached him and complained over the gunfire. McElroy proceeded to shoot Henry in the face twice. Henry survived, and McElroy was charged with assault with a deadly weapon. But again, the charges were dismissed after McElroy denied he was on the property or fired the shots. Henry took the stand at trial, countered McElroy's statements, claiming that the other man had parked in front of and driven around his home over 100 times in an attempt to intimidate him. This, in turn, was countered when McElroy had two of his friends, fellow raccoon hunters, who testified that he was with them at the time of the shooting. McElroy's lawyers were able to force Henry to admit on the stand that he had a petty criminal record that dated back well over 30 years, and in the end, Ken McElroy was acquitted of all charges. This was how things went in Ken McElroy's life, and the people of Skidmore rightfully feared him. As I've stated previously, he did whatever he wanted. Anytime the law became involved, the charges eventually went away. Things wouldn't stay that way, however. In 1981, one of McElroy's sons got into an argument with Evelyn Sonny at the local grocery store, which was owned by Ernest Bo Bowenkamp and his wife, Lois. Evelyn said that the boy had attempted to steal some candy, and from everything I could find, the child was at the grocery store with Trina. And they left the store, and word got back to McElroy, who went to the grocery store to confront the clerk. Instead, he ended up getting into a shouting match with Bowenkamp. The fallout from this was that McElroy began to stalk the Bowenkamp family with his normal tactics, sitting outside the family home for hours on end, driving around the block, making threats to the family, making threats to the family's neighbors. He was really just pushing his luck at this point, throwing his weight around. Things came to a head later that year when McElroy confronted Bowenkamp in the back of the store yet again, this time with a shotgun in hand. And from all accounts, they were screaming at each other. McElroy was yet telling the man that he needed to take back what he'd said about his son, you know, because how dare he besmirch the good name of the McElroys. And Ken McElroy ended up shooting Bo Bowenkamp in the neck with the shotgun. Somehow, Bowenkamp survived his wounds and proceeded to press charges against McElroy, even naming him in the court documents. McElroy was arrested and charged with attempted murder. This was, so far as I could find, the only conviction that McElroy ever received. He was convicted on simple assault charges, but he was released on bail pending his appeal. Immediately after that, McElroy went to the D&D Tavern with an M1 Garand rifle with a bayonet attached to it and began telling anyone who would listen. I've read a couple different statements that have said McElroy was making extremely graphic proclamations about the things he was going to do with them. So much so that the locals who were in the bar went to see what they could legally do to prevent McElroy from carrying out his threats. This is where Sheriff Dan Estes of Nodaway County comes into the story, because he suggested that they form a neighborhood watch. Now, I've found nothing that says whether or not they actually followed his advice, but what is known is that McElroy was able to get his appeals process pushed back further, meaning he would be able to stay out on the streets longer. And this both enraged and terrified the people in Skidmore, because they had no idea how far Ken McElroy was willing to go. He'd proven himself over the years to be a ruthless, cunning bully, and given his recent statements and past history of violence, they really suspected he was going to carry through with his threats and kill the Bowen family, as well as anyone else who got in his way. And this brings us to the morning of July 10th, 1981.
First, this message. Authors and small business owners, are you looking for an inexpensive, effective way to promote your business and get new customers? Promoting on a podcast such as this one will introduce your product to hundreds of new potential customers on a daily basis. I can tell you from my own experience, having done it, that promoting through a podcast is the best investment I ever made. My last two books, The Throwaway Girls of Olympia and The House of Silver Doors, were both promoted on the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry podcast, and I saw immediate results, with sales nearly doubling overnight. Now, I know what you're thinking, promoting on a podcast has to be expensive. Well, that's not true. If you contact me at authorIanTotten at gmail.com, that's AUTHORIANTOTTEN at gmail.com, I promise you I will give you the best deal on podcast advertising going today. I can tell you from trying to run ads on other shows, you can end up spending it from $5 to over $1,000 a placement. But if you contact me today at authorIanTotten at gmail.com, I'm going to give you 2 weeks for the price of one, and it's not even going to cost you a fraction of that. Now, the best part about placing an ad on a podcast is there's no shelf life to that ad, unlike a place like Facebook where you have to put an end to your ad campaign. I'm not going to go back through and re-edit the podcast to remove your ad, so it's going to be there permanently. So contact me at authorIanTotten at gmail.com and expand your business today.
Alright, so I've already gone over what happened with Ken McElroy on that fateful morning of July 10th. One thing I left out of the trailer is the fact that Sheriff Estes left town after warning the townsfolk not to confront McElroy. After the shooting, no one bothered to call for an ambulance that includes McElroy's wife, Trina. There are conflicting accounts as to the amount of people who were there to witness it, but the general consensus seems to be we're around 48 residents of Skidmore in the town center that morning, none of whom were able to identify the shooter. Again, you have to remember, pretty much everyone there was firing on the truck from the accounts that I have read. Trina did claim she was able to identify the shooter, but this never came to anything, as the DA's office declined to prosecute, which isn't surprising given the circumstances of McElroy's murder. The FBI did get involved in this case. They, too, declined to press charges against anyone. In 1984, Trina filed a wrongful death suit against the town of Skidmore, the town's mayor, the sheriff of Nodaway County itself, and a man by the name of Del Clement, whom she claimed was the shooter. Clement was the part owner of the D&D Tavern. Clement died in 2009, having never admitted guilt. Eventually, the case was settled out of court, with Trina receiving just shy of $18,000 in compensation. Trina died on her 55th birthday in 2012 from cancer. So that's it, really, and I know you're thinking, man, this was a short story this week. But we're not done yet. Skidmore continued to ramble on, and I know you're thinking, what do you mean it rambled on? Every town rambles on. Yeah, but Skidmore skids some more right into a ditch. Bloosh! Thank you. I'll be here all week. Don't forget to tip your waitresses. No, really, Skidmore did ramble on, declining each year in population and in prosperity. And despite this, maybe because of it, Skidmore continued to make national headlines. Ken McElroy's murder at the hands of vigilantes would not be the only time that Skidmore was splashed across the front pages of newspapers. The first time would be in 2000, when Wendy Gillenwater, who was born on January 19th, 1975, was murdered by her boyfriend. And the way this came to be is, at the age of 19, Wendy hooked up with a guy by the name of Gregory Dragoo, who has been described as a violent, controlling drug addict whose mood swings became even worse when he was under the influence, which, knowing what I know about drug addiction and alcoholism, is not surprising at all. On October 16th, 2000, Gregory became upset with Wendy and began to beat her mercilessly, fracturing ribs, causing internal lacerations and bleeding. One of Wendy's lungs collapsed. Her liver was even pierced. Greg beat her so badly that he actually bruised the tops of his own feet from kicking her. He even poured liquid dish soap down her throat before chaining her to the back of his pickup truck and dragging her through the back roads around Skidmore, finally stopping in front of their house where he dropped her body. He called police on himself, and when they arrived, he was sitting on his front stoop, after which he gave a full account of what had happened. The body was so savagely beaten and disfigured, Wendy's mother had to identify her from the rings that she wore. Gregory was eventually convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But Skidmore wasn't done yet. Less than a year later, on April 11, 2001, a young man by the name of Branson Kane Perry vanished. This one is weird. Perry was born February 24th, 1981, had been a lifelong resident of Skidmore, and after graduating in 1999, he worked various jobs in the area while living at home with his father. He was a black belt in Hapkido, which led some to speculate later that he would have fought off anyone who had come to attack him. Now, Perry was a closeted homosexual, and in a place like Skidmore, from all the things that I have seen, it appears that was not an accepted lifestyle. At any rate, on April 7th, 2001, Perry visited one of his neighbors, a guy by the name of Jason Bierman, and was drugged by Bierman, after which Perry proceeded to dance around the house naked before shaving his pubic hair, and the two men had sex. Afterwards, Perry confided in his father what had happened and said that he was ashamed over the incident. Perry's father later said that he knew his son was homosexual, did not have an issue with it, but he was enraged at Bierman for taking advantage of his son. Now, this is where things get weird. Just a few days later, Perry invited one of his friends, a girl named Gina, over to the house to help clean, as Perry's father was in the hospital and was due to arrive home soon. There were two other men at the house outside who were working on the father's car, changing out the alternator. At some point, approximately around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Perry told Gina he was going to go get a pair of jumper cables from a shed to give to the men. It was the last time he was ever seen. So the following day, Perry's grandmother stopped by the home and found it abandoned and unlocked, which she found unusual, and she called the house over the next few days trying to find her grandson. She even went so far as to call Perry's mother, who had recently divorced the father, only to be told that she had neither seen nor heard from her son. I find it really odd that at this point nobody thought to file a missing persons report. I think there might be something more going on than what has been released to the public or been stated by the family. At any rate, on April 17th, Perry's father was released from the hospital and he immediately put in a missing persons report. There was a huge search formed for the young man. They searched the surrounding woods, abandoned buildings, sheds, any place that they thought it might be likely that either he or his body could have been stored. One thing of note, however, is that the jumper cables Perry was going to either get or return, I found conflicting reports on that even, were unable to be located. However, 2 weeks later, they were found, just inside the door to the shed that Perry had been going to. The police questioned a lot of people, over 100 in fact. His friend Jenna said that Perry had begun experimenting with marijuana and amphetamines, and it was learned that he had a bottle of Valium on him the day that he disappeared. Following this line of questioning, the police went to the town of St. Joseph and interviewed a number of individuals who were known to be drug users and acquaintances of Perry, none of whom said they had seen him, and even though they really don't mean much, all of these individuals did pass polygraph tests. The case pretty much went cold from there. Perry's father stated at the time he thought maybe his son had taken off to Kansas City due to the embarrassment he had over the sexual encounter from a few days prior, but nothing seemed to pan out. This case has had a couple of different twists and turns, one of them being the April 10th, 2003 arrest of 59-year-old Presbyterian minister and Boy Scout leader Jack Wayne Rogers on child pornography and assault charges, the assault charges stemming from Rogers performing a gender reassignment surgery on a trans woman by removing said woman's genitals in a hotel room, during which complications arose and Rogers was unable to stop the bleeding. I mean, to me, all of this sounds just like a bad made-for-TV movie on Lifetime or something. But that's besides the point. Rogers' personal belongings were searched, and child pornography was found on his computer, as well as evidence of various posts he made on message boards under a number of different pseudonyms, during which he described the torture, mutilation, and murder of various young men. One thing that grabbed the attention of law enforcement was that Rogers claimed in numerous messages to have eaten the genitals of men he had performed surgery on. One of these young men was a blonde-haired boy he had picked up, tortured, mutilated, and then murdered before dropping the body in the Ozarks. Naturally, this raised red flags to the police, and they questioned Rogers on Perry's disappearance. He denied ever meeting or encountering the boy, stating that the posts were nothing more than flights of fancy he had put up to make himself seem more dangerous than he actually was. However, a necklace, a turtle claw necklace, was found in his possession that closely resembled one that Perry was known to have worn at the time of his disappearance. Rogers was convicted in April 2004 and sentenced to 17 years. The police said at the time that they were not ruling Rogers out as a possible suspect in Perry's disappearance and possible murder, although Perry's mother has stated since then that she does not believe Rogers is connected in any way, shape, or form with her son's disappearance. Perry's father died in 2004. In 2009, police stated that they were excavating a site in Quitman, Missouri, after receiving a tip that Perry's body might be buried there. Sadly, nothing was found. Perry's mother died in February of 2011, and it seems that the case has gone cold since then. The one thing, at least to me, that it seems odd is that the police haven't taken a harder look at the man who supposedly sexually assaulted Perry shortly before his disappearance. I mean, I'm not saying he did anything or had anything to do with Perry's disappearance, but it seems odd that something like that happens and then the kid just vanishes so quickly afterwards. That seems like the type of thing the police would want to look into, and maybe they have and they just haven't found anything and decided to leave the man be. Again, Skidmore is pretty backwater town, so being gay in an area like that might be much more difficult for an individual to encounter others like themselves and form relationships, and maybe the guy just didn't know how to go about propositioning Perry over it and went about it the wrong way. Who knows? The last case we're going to look at is the murder of Bobby Joe Stinnett, who was a cousin of Perry, which in and of itself on the surface seems odd that two things would happen to a family only a few short years apart. Bobby Joe was born December 4th, 1981, and was pregnant with her first child at the time of her murder. She and her husband ran a dog breeding business from their home in Skidmore. Just a few days after her 23rd birthday, on December 16th of 2004, Bobby Joe was at her home waiting for a prospective buyer to show up to look at the puppies that she had. At some point during the day, Bobby Joe's mother, Becky, arrived at the house and found her daughter lying dead in a pool of blood, the baby cut from her womb. When she called police, Becky described the scene as looking like her daughter's stomach had exploded. This case was solved fairly quickly. In fact, the next day, 36-year-old Lisa Marie Montgomery was arrested in a farmhouse in Kansas City with the newborn child that she had claimed as her own in tow. When the police broke into the farmhouse, they found Montgomery standing in the living room with the baby in her arms, watching the Amber Alert that had been issued for the unborn child. Police were able to find Montgomery so quickly because of the extensive use of emails between the two. The baby, which was 8 months old and happy and healthy, was returned to Bobby Joe's husband. Montgomery, who went under the pseudonym of Darlene Fisher, had met Bobby Joe in an online chat room dedicated to rat terriers. She had confided to Bobby Joe that she herself was pregnant, as well as looking for a dog. The two women exchanged emails over the course of a few months concerning both their pregnancies and the dogs, which eventually led to them setting up a meeting for Montgomery to come and claim one of Bobby Joe's dogs. Investigators learned that Montgomery, who was the mother to four children, had had a miscarriage at some point, as well as a tubal ligation surgery in 1990, and according to her ex-husband, had a history of making false claims of pregnancies. Some background on Montgomery: she claimed to have been sexually abused by her father growing up, through which she sought escape from drinking alcohol, and that when her mother found out about the abuse, she threatened her daughter with a gun. Eventually, Montgomery married a man at the age of 18 to escape the abuse, but instead found herself in another abusive relationship. She divorced this man and married once more, only to find further abuse. Now, this is only speculation on my part, but given her prior history of claiming false pregnancies, coupled with the crime for which she committed, it seems to me that Montgomery might have been suffering from some form of mental illness. And this is actually bolstered by a neurosurgeon who testified at pretrial hearings that Montgomery did in fact have some head traumas, which may have affected the part of her brain that controlled aggression. During trial, her defense attorneys claimed that she suffered from pseudocyesis, which is repeated claims of false pregnancies, and can be so extreme in some cases that the women may actually have symptoms such as tender breasts and secretions, abdominal growth, missed or late menstrual cycles, and a sensation of a moving fetus inside of the body. Further testimony was given, labeling Montgomery as a depressive borderline personality who suffered from post-traumatic stress. Testimony was also given that Montgomery's actions fluctuated, thus causing the stories she gave others to fluctuate, and that she was so mentally ill she was unable to differentiate between right or wrong, or grasp the nature of the crimes which she had committed. This was contested by prosecutors who had their own expert witnesses, and on October 22, 2007, jurors found Montgomery guilty, and she was eventually sentenced to death by lethal injection. She has had a few different hearings since then, with the defense claiming that certain evidence concerning her mental condition had not been allowed to be presented to juries. All of these were denied. Despite experts who examined her after her conviction stating that she was often in a delusional state. Montgomery is currently the only woman on the federal execution list. She is housed at the Federal Medical Center, Carswell, in Fort Worth, Texas. She was scheduled to be executed on December 8, 2020, which is just about 2 weeks away, but the execution date was pushed back to January 12, 2021 because her lawyers contracted COVID. So at least for me, it'll be interesting to see whether or not this awful human being's execution is carried out. That is it. As I stated earlier, Skidmore's story continued to get more bizarre following the murder of Ken McElroy and the subsequent events. It's amazing the town of Skidmore even exists. In 1980, 437 people were estimated to be living in the town. Last year, 2019, it is estimated that only 257 remain. So, much like Montgomery's execution date, it's going to be interesting to see what happens to this town of Skidmore, if it's going to continue to exist, if there'll be any more mysterious disappearances or murders. This is the kind of stuff that I just find fascinating and concern myself with during my free time. Our book of the week this week is In Broad Daylight by Harry MacLean. If you've never read this book, it is similar in nature and scope, as well as writing style, to Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. It's a really amazing book that I can't recommend highly enough. That's it for the Deathcast this week. Again, I am your host, Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for coming with me through this journey into darkness. Stay safe out there, and until next time, stay morbid.
Deathcast.